Hello, this is Brittany Cramsey, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight. I'm here with State Senator Jay Costa, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question at any point during our call tonight, you can press star 3 on your phone's keypad. Now, let's welcome Senator Jay Costa.
Well, thank you very much, Brittany, and thank you all of you who are listening on the phone this evening and participating in our telephone live telephone town hall. Our purpose of this is something we do 3 or 4 times a year just to get feedback from our constituency. I always find this to be a better way to hear from more folks than the traditional town hall meetings, which we will be doing, by the way, as we go forward. But tonight we wanted to focus a little bit on the governor's budget address. We heard today the governor made a budget proposal, but also I really want to hear from some of the concerns that you have about state government or things that are going on in our respective communities. To learn about what you may need us to do or look into, and so be able to pose those questions. You have an opportunity to do that, and we look forward to hearing from folks as we do this. We have a couple email questions, I think, have already been presented. But I want to just jump into the governor's budget address. You know, today was the statutory day for the governor to, you know, make his budget address to the General Assembly. And it's our job now to take that budget and review it. And through the course of the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks, we will have budget hearings here in Harrisburg where each of the agencies who the governor has recommended resources for will have the opportunity to make the case as to why we should support their budget proposal to the governor that the governor has put forth in his overall general appropriation bill. There's a number of policy issues that will be associated and tied to that we can talk about as well. But from the fiscal side, the governor's budget address is one that this year calls for a no broad-based tax increase, which I think is good news, as our constituents would like to hear. So we always try to start with that. The other part of it is it's going to be a little under $36.1 billion budget. The overall federal budget combined with the state budget is around $89 billion. There's a significant portion of federal dollars. This year, continuing the trend that the governor has established over the course of the past several years, Governor Wolf, again, is making recommendations that we wholeheartedly support and have always been a priority of myself and our Democratic caucus, and that is investing in education at all levels of education, from pre-K and early learning through higher ed. And the governor does that again this year. He's asking for significant resources in the K-12, $100 million. $25 million increase is proposed for the pre-K starts program, 5 more for Head Start. If we're able to accomplish this, it'll put us in excess of an additional $100 million we've added to the early learning programs over the course of the past 4 years. Also making some changes in the area of higher ed. The governor's putting forth a program that would provide $200 million to our students who attend our state system schools. For us folks in the West, that would be IUP, Edinburgh, Slippery Rock, Clarion, and many other parts of the state system of higher education, 14 schools there. It's basically a loan and interest forgiveness program if they agree to stay in the Commonwealth for 6 years. More details of the proposal will be forthcoming as we go forward, but that's one of the things I think is really important. It's called the Nellie Bly Scholarship Fund, which is an important aspect. But most importantly, as I mentioned, the resources the governor is putting into early learning, to me, as I said many times on this program, are some of the best dollars that we spend. And also, the governor's making a significant investment, $15 million we're going to draw down with additional resources from the federal government to include in child care. A number of other areas where we're talking about some investments that are important. In the area of economic development, the governor's putting forth about $12 million in a manufacturing initiative. Folks may remember we rolled this out last week in Pittsburgh, and the governor was in Pittsburgh discussing it. And working with our industrial resource centers and working with our universities and our Ben Franklins, being able to provide resources for those entities that are going to work to grow jobs in this technological space, innovation manufacturing space, which we think is really important. And quite frankly, we in Pittsburgh are at the center of that conversation across the state. In terms of environmental programs, the governor is adding more resources to DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, something we've been asking for a long time. There's a lot of questions about the ability to have the department comply or have folks who are able to monitor making certain folks are complying with the regulations across the Marcellus industry, but also with respect to the air quality programming that we have, and adding more money and specifically to support the Bureau of Air Quality with an additional $1.5 million. That's going to be an important component to what the governor's doing there, but adding more resources to put more folks boots on the ground with respect to checking on and making sure things are being done in an appropriate way. School violence is another area where the governor's adding more resources, and it's an issue that we've talked about. Last year, we were successful in garnering $5 million through the work of Representative Franco and myself to be able to provide to nonprofits for security purposes at entities along those lines. Governor's going to continue making resources that we've supported, been advocating for, in terms of resources that will go into gun violence task force programs, for example. Working through the Attorney General's office has been a successful program, but also through with PCCD, which is our Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency. So there's a number of resources totaling about close to about $11 million that will go into that space as well. And those are important aspects of the governor's budget. Many other items have been flat funded that we'll talk about, and we'll try to grow those aspects of that. But that's just a high-level summary of where we are with regard to the governor's budget proposal. As I indicated, we'll flush it out over the course of the next 3 or 4 weeks. And by June 30th, we will have an agreed-to budget here in the Senate and in the House as well, and we'll move forward. That being said, Brittany, I'm ready to take some questions if folks have been already calling in and asking questions already.
Yes, we've gotten a few come in over the line. Just to remind everybody that's on the phone, if you have a question for Senator Costa about the budget, any sort of legislation that you've heard about or things happening in the district, please hit *3. We'll try to answer your question on the line here. So first, I'm going to go to a question that we got a few weeks ago when we announced this town hall from Greg in Pittsburgh. He says that you've been a strong supporter in the growth of renewable energy in Pennsylvania, including wind and solar generation. And with studies stating clearly that strong, sustained growth of solar energy in our state will create tens of thousands of jobs, lower the cost of electricity, and improve the quality of air that we all breathe, will you support new legislation seeking to expand Pennsylvania's existing alternative energy portfolio standard, thus bringing Pennsylvania's solar development competitiveness on par with those of surrounding states?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm a major co-sponsor to legislation that I believe my colleague Senator Steve Santacero and others have introduced along those lines to really making requiring that we certainly expand our renewable component to the standards, but also making certain that we have 10% with respect to the wind and solar, particularly the solar piece. Myself, I'm working on legislation, local solar legislation, that would essentially allow for those individuals who want to participate in getting their electricity through a solar program and not in a position to be able to do so because of where they live or whatever, that we would be able to have them tied into what I'll call a solar farm that would be managed by an entity that would be able to purchase the power from those folks. Those are just a couple of things that we're working on right now, but certainly we need to modify our standards to incorporate more in line of the renewable energy that's becoming more and more prevalent. The other piece of that is the jobs that are created from this space, and I think that's some of the things that we have to continue to talk about. You know, growing jobs in our economy and our region is an important aspect of what we need to do in the legislature and in the government, and I do believe that we can make a strong case that Pennsylvania has already been a leader in terms of growing these renewable jobs, and there's more that we can do, and as we transition more and more away from the fossil fuels, we have an opportunity to be able to grow in that space as well.
Okay, great. We actually had a few questions come in online to the same effect, so I think you've pretty well answered questions about solar energy. Again, if you have a question for Senator Costa, please press *3. We're going to go now to a question from Heidi in South Hills. Heidi, you are live.
Oh, hello, Senator Costa. Yeah, I was wondering when Pennsylvania is going to up their minimum wage, because a lot of people with the minimum wage, what it is, it's 7 1/4, which is really low. A lot of people work 2 or 3 jobs just to maintain their existence with the food and their rent, or it's just awful. I know Washington State has a minimum wage of $15 an hour. I think maybe we should up our minimum wage to maybe 12. What do you think?
I totally agree. I just stepped out and grabbed the regional minimum wage for all the states around us. Pennsylvania, as you mentioned, at 7 1/4. Maryland, which is 45 miles from where I'm sitting here in Harrisburg, has a minimum wage of $11,000, or $11 an hour. The difference is $7,500 annually for somebody who works in a job in Pennsylvania versus in Maryland. That's what we have to change. New Jersey's $11. Delaware's 9 1/4. West Virginia is $1.50 higher, which is about $3,000 a year more for a person working in the same job. we have to make changes to the minimum wage law. We passed something here last December that we sent over to the House that would call for increasing it over a couple of years to $9.50 an hour. That's still not enough. We need to go a minimum to $12 with a plan to go to $15. I supported the $9.50 proposal the governor gave to us and asked us to support because I didn't want to stand in the way of denying folks the opportunity to earn $4,600 more annually. But our goal needs to be at a minimum $12. Today, the governor made a proposal to increase it to $12 an hour and grow it to $15. I'll be very, very clear. Democrats and Senate Democrats and myself support increasing the minimum wage to a higher level. We simply can't get support from our Republican colleagues, and that's what we're working on here in Harrisburg.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Heidi. Next, we have a question from Lisa in Penn Hills. Lisa, you are live.
Yes. Hi, Senator Costa.
Hi, Lisa.
I have a two-part question. First, I'd like to know, is there anything being set up to test to make sure our water is safe in Penn Hills, given what happened in the city of Pittsburgh a few years back where they had to get water filters? Has anything been initiated with that? And then my other question is also, are there any programs for people within this area that would be interested in starting a small business?
So the first question, I will double back with Wilkes-Penn Joint Water Authority to confirm, but my understanding is that they have been doing testing along those lines, but I will confirm that. And if you have a particular issue, a particular concern you have, reach out to my office at 412-241-6690. We'll figure out a way to get some testing out to your location and figure out what steps can be taken along those lines. There has been a lot of work that's been done in the city of Pittsburgh with respect to the lines, the lead lines, both on the public side but also on the private lateral side, and the same conversation needs to take place outside the city of Pittsburgh as well. I will tell you on the second point, there are programs that assist small businesses. I always refer folks to the small business development centers, either Duquesne University or Pitt, but we have some resources available, not financial resources, but other resources available to help folks navigate through the process of trying to establish their own business. We're willing to be able to give my office a call. We'll sit down and work with you along those lines. But there are some programs through the Department of Community Economic Development, many of which the governor has put forth again in the budget. But there's sometimes specific, particularly around job tax credits, for example. If you're going to grow jobs in a region, there's some tax credits available along those lines. There are other programs like the Ben Franklin program that makes investments typically in high-tech position jobs along those lines, and they're important programs, but you know, we need to have a conversation about how they work for folks who are trying to start a small business.
Okay, thank you, Senator Costa.
Thank you very much for listening.
All right, we've gotten a few questions submitted online as well. Here's one from Deborah. She says, it's been about a year since the fire broke out at the Claritin Coke Works and you held a hearing to address air quality. How are the initiatives you've undertaken come along? Is there any update there?
The update would be that there are a couple things that have gone on. I think as a result of the hearing and the position that myself and many others have taken with respect to the air quality in the Mon Valley communities that are part of that, U.S. Steel has taken significant steps in terms of trying to address the air quality. Quite frankly, they haven't gone far enough in my view, but we have more work to do, but I think there's been something along those lines. And I support the work that the Allegheny County Health Department has done with respect to the fines and things along those lines. It's frustrating when they consistently appeal some of the orders from the Department of Health, and that's been frustrating to us. Representative Austin Davis has been at the forefront as working on that along with Senator Katie Muth here from Harrisburg area, and making certain that we are looking to have information shared with the individuals in the communities when there are, in fact, for example, a fire like there was last Christmas or on that weekend. And so that's something we're working on. But I think we are on the path, and I think we've gotten the attention of the principal players down there in the Mon Valley, and we're going to continue to monitor along those lines. There are a variety of things that we're doing here in Harrisburg to clean the air. I mentioned to you the governor's added more money for a bureau of air quality. That'll be something that'll be part of that conversation as well. So we're doing what we can along those lines, but at the end of the day, U.S. Steel, I think, has become a little bit responsive, but certainly there's more we can ask of them.
All right. Reminder to everybody on the phone, if you have a question, please hit *3 at any point, and we will try to answer you on the line here. We have a question now from Roz Sherman in Pittsburgh. He wants to talk about cost of living increases for retired teachers. You are on the line now, Sherman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Costa. Thank you for making yourself available to take questions from the public. My question, and it's not really a question, it's a comment. The state legislature has had several cost of living increases for themselves over the last 20 years and nothing for retired teachers. Some of our teachers retired when they were making $15,000 and $20,000 a year, and their pensions are pitiful. When will the legislature do something? And I know you're going to blame it on the Republicans, but the point is that the Democrats are not doing enough to highlight this situation. Retired teachers deserve to have a decent standard of living, period.
I agree with you, and I'm not going to blame it on the Republicans. And there's no question that we need to do more along those lines. At the end of last year, we had a serious conversation with respect to modifying our pension systems again, and the work that we were going to do out of Act 205 that was related to the financial investors and modifying and collaborating both the CSRS and PSRS into one so that we can unify those departments and those individuals to cut down on several hundred million dollars in investment fees that were being paid to private entities. Part of that conversation included a plan to provide for a cost of living increase for those individuals who are pre-Act 9, and that's what we tried to do. As you remember, under Act 9, folks who just before they retired received a 25% increase in their pension. Folks who retired before that were not eligible for that. So that was an important aspect of what we tried to address back in December. We could not reach a consensus on it, Democrats and Republicans. And we have more work to do in that space. I would say to you that part of it is a function of the cost associated with it and trying to find the resources to be able to do it. At the end of the day, it becomes a priority issue, how we prioritize and how we value the work that our teachers and our administrators and our state employees did prior to Act 9. So we need to address that going forward, and I hope to be able to do that, maybe possibly through this budget process.
All right, Roz, thank you for your question. I think there was something interesting for active teachers in the governor's budget proposal today, something with the base salary.
Yes, the governor again this year, thanks for reminding me, Brittany, the governor again this year proposed increasing the base salary for our school teachers to $45,000 a year. There are a number of school districts across Pennsylvania who do not pay their starting school teacher salaries in the $45,000 range. So the governor would increase it. It's probably been like 40 years since it's been increased, and I think the last time it was increased to $17,000. So the governor would be able, folks, the school districts would be able to use that extra $100 million that they've received and to be able to pay teachers a level of $45,000 when they start going forward. That certainly has a benefit to someone's pension as we move forward a number of years later.
All right, we're going to go to another question from Miguel Sugge in Verona. You are live.
Thank you. Senator Costa, my question is related to the approaching second anniversary of the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. I just participated in a spoken word project in which different Pittsburghers and people from the Pittsburgh area were asked to make a record of their impressions on the coming second anniversary this October. And I want to relate that to what Governor Wolf mentioned. The Philadelphia Inquirer puts it this way: Democratic governor also departed from the boundaries of a traditional budget speech to make a strong plea for stricter gun laws. I want to hear what your opinion is on this, on his proposal for stricter reporting requirements, lost and stolen firearms, red flag laws, and so on.
I agree with the governor, and I commend the governor for taking probably a third of his remarks today to address the gun violence epidemic we have in our Commonwealth in many of our urban settings. I support the governor and what he's talked about, and have been a consistent supporter of addressing the things you talked about. The extreme risk order protections, I think, is something we need to do going forward. That's a simple one in my mind. It's got bipartisan support. It's got unanimous support from the Democrats here in our caucus, but I think in the Senate it probably passes overwhelmingly. The problem there is in the House is not willing to take up that piece of legislation, and that's disappointing. But I'm supportive of that and will continue to be supportive. Lost and stolen guns. Reporting of lost and stolen guns is something that's important as well. I support that measure. Universal background checks. I support that measure going forward. Looking at some other things along the lines of making sure that we're addressing, for example, the magazine capacity, for example, and the number of bullets that are in a particular magazine, for example. Those are some of the things that I will continue to support. One gun a month is legislation that I support. And then the assault weapons is very much a controversial issue. But in my mind, I can't wrap around my head the need for civilians to have some of these automatic weapons that that folks are being able to purchase that are automatic assault weapons. That concerns me. So that's a series of measures that we continue to advance and will continue to fight for. But that's a high priority of mine and my Democratic colleagues here in the Senate.
Thank you.
All right, Miguel, thank you for your question. Anyone on the line, if you have a question for Senator Casa, you can press *3. We have an interesting question now from Karen and Carrick about the process of passing a law. Karen, you're live.
Thank you very much, Senator, for taking my call.
Sure, Karen.
First of all, why does it take so long between, like, say, your Senate bill that you proposed that passed in the Senate and went to the House? Why does it take so long to go from being proposed to being put into law? And why, when some of them are passed, is it like, okay, well, this bill passed, but it'll go into effect in June 30th of 2020, rather than having it go through the Senate, go through the House, or vice versa, and be accepted and signed into law by the governor? Why doesn't it go into effect immediately?
So thank you for that question. The answer to the latter part of your question, it depends upon what the legislation says. Sometimes it says effective immediately, sometimes 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. Oftentimes it's associated with the opportunity to implement some of the changes that are being recommended in that piece of legislation. That's probably the main reason along those lines, giving folks, whether it be an agency or a department, or communities, the opportunity to inform folks that the law has changed and what steps they need to take to adhere to that law. With respect to the process, we operate here in the Senate in Harrisburg as party control. The parties control the process, the majority party, that is. Democrats serve in the minority, so it's the Republican Party that controls the advancement of legislation. If they like an idea, a piece of legislation, they advance it. If they don't like it, or if it's a Democratic measure, in many instances, they don't advance it. We have to work around those parameters to make sure those barriers, to make sure we're able to include our measures as amendments and various other bills to be able to do that. But the reason they all don't move forward in a consistent way is that we don't have a process by which every member, for example, should get one bill to be voted on, which I would support, or every bill that makes its way into committee gets a vote in committee at a minimum. Those are some of the reforms that we're advocating for at this point in time, but we've not been able to secure them because we're not in position to do that. I will tell you, over the course, I think since January 1 of 2019, the Senate has passed about 250 bills. I will tell you that only about 12 to 13 of them have been Democratic measures. There's a problem along those lines. Bills with good ideas are not being considered because of partisan politics, quite frankly. That's got to change, in my view. And at any point in time, we're able to get to 25 votes or 26 votes in the Senate, that will be one of the reforms we will be talking about.
Okay. And the second part of my question was, if someone has an idea to propose legislation for a bill, how do you get either a senator or a House of Representatives member to
introduce
write
it?
For the, yes.
Yeah. So I would suggest you give me a call, meet with me. I'm happy to meet with you, sit down and talk about it, and consider introducing it. At the minimum, we can get it through the Legislative Reference Bureau, the attorneys who help us draft bills. They put it in the appropriate legal form it needs to be in to be considered as a piece of legislation. So we're happy to work with you. If you have an idea that you want to bring to us, we're happy to sit down and chat with you about it and get that process done. But that's typically how it happens. A member has an idea, they convert the idea into legislation, and then it's introduced here in the Senate or in the House, wherever the case may be.
Okay, because I'm actually I'm retired and I am disabled, and I am a member of something called Don't Punish the Pain group. Actually, there's going to be a rally on March 20th in Harrisburg, Philadelphia, and one in Pittsburgh also. And some of the members in other states, like I know they're doing it up in Rhode Island, where the head of the organization, Claudia Morandi, had has a senator that wrote the bill, or, you know, however the process is, wrote the bill, and it's going, it was passed in the Senate and is going to the House. There's also a similar one in Texas and Oklahoma, I believe, so far.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, but I was interested in getting something like that done in the state of Pennsylvania, because with the things that happen with the CDC guidelines and
right.
FDA and DEA and everything else, the legitimate pain patients who follow their prescriptions, do their urine checks, do their pill counts, follow their, you know, contract with their pain doctors, are being hurt by what had happened with that stuff.
And there's no question, the opioid crisis, we've responded to that by putting limitations on access to narcotics and narcotics along those lines. So do me a favor, call my office at 412-241-6690. I'm happy to sit down with you and chat with you about what ideas that you have or what other states have done that you'd like to see us consider here in Pennsylvania. So I appreciate the call and looking forward to talking to you about it.
All right, Senator, we're about halfway through our time today, and I know you have a couple of events coming up in the district that we want to let people know are happening.
Yeah, I do want to share with folks. We have a couple events going on. One is going to be on Wednesday, March 4th in my Forest Hills office, 1501 Ardmore Boulevard. It's National Consumer Protection Week, and I've asked the Attorney General's Office, the Bureau of Consumer Protection, to come to the office and meet with folks who have concerns or questions about consumer protection matters, and also be able to accept consumer complaints. So if you have a complaint about something you've dealt with or something that's going on, you're able to come in and meet with folks from the Attorney General's Office in our office to be able to discuss that. Wednesday, March 4th from 2 to 5 p.m. We're also going to do a Real ID event on March 19th. I'm teaming up with Representative Sarah Innamorato on March 19th at 6 to 9, 8 p.m. at West Penn Hospital Conference Center in Bloomfield. We're going to be holding another Real ID information event, provide folks with information about what needs to be done in order to obtain and what documents you need in order to obtain your Real ID. As you know, this is going to be an issue at the end of this year, I think October this year, where folks are going to have to figure out whether they're going to either have the regular ID or do a Real ID if they want to travel and they want to enter federal buildings. It's a requirement that we need to look at, and we have folks who are going to be there to answer questions along the lines of helping folks understand exactly what they need to do, folks from the Department of Health, folks from our Social Security Administration, and other advocates who will be there to assist us. So those are two upcoming events that we have. I'll also be forwarding information pretty soon about doing another shredding event in the district. Probably do one again in early April, as we typically do, and just want to be cognizant of the holidays in mid-April, so we will work a date in along those lines. We've not determined a location yet, but we will be doing another one very, very soon.
Okay. Anybody on the line, if you have questions, please hit *3. We have a couple more waiting in the queue here. So let's get back to talking about the budget. Roberta in Penn Hills has a question about that. And Roberta, you're live.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question, and thank you for doing this gathering by phone.
Happy to do so.
I have great concern that in Pennsylvania, we do not tax shale, fracking, and those kinds of industries. And we, our area, as well as the rest of the world, is in a climate crisis. And I don't understand why those industries are not taxed, and what can we do about that?
Well, I think one thing is, I agree, we should be imposing an extraction tax. I have supported an extraction tax for the last several years. I think it's something that's warranted in Pennsylvania. We do have in place something called an impact fee that the individual companies that are doing the extraction have to pay the impact fee. It generates about $200 million a year for the Commonwealth, which is distributed mostly back to the communities where the drilling is taking place, but also into various programs that are used to be able to help advance other environmentally conscious type programs. So we are doing some of it, but we're not getting enough. Governor has again proposed today that he will continue to advance what's called the Restore PA program that would create $4.5 billion fund that would allow for the remediation of situate like landslides, for example, to address flood mitigation matters, to look at infrastructure improvements, to water and sewer lines. Our broadband, you know, we have a real serious issue with broadband across many parts of Pennsylvania, and we're fortunate in Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, we don't have to deal with it, but, you know, drive 50 miles away and it's a different story. So we are going to continue to advocate for Marcellus Shale as something that needs to be taxed, an extraction tax along those lines.
I also have a question, comment regarding education.
Yes.
I am a Penn State graduate from the 70s, and I was in a position where I worked three jobs, and I received Pell Grants, which were substantial, and lesser loans, and I went on to become a vice president of several billion-dollar companies. And that was because of my education and also my education from Penn Hills in the early 70s. I received an excellent education. It used to be a wonderful school district. And I would like to know what we can do about the cost of education. I have two millennial children who are, my daughter's a teacher. Actually, she's a preschool teacher. And she has $30,000 in debt, and she receives scholarships and awards and all everything she could possibly get. But I, unfortunately, was not well and had to quit work and couldn't supplement her
you have raised an issue that's a priority issue for myself and others, and like you, I have kids that have student debt as well that they've addressed and continue to address. We are one of the worst states with respect to cost of tuition and educating our kids in higher education. We tried to take steps to address it. I'll go back to 2011, when we reduced our spending in the state system schools and our state-related schools by 20%. We've never recovered from that, although we've tried the last 5 years to put more dollars into education in the higher ed space. We need to do more along those lines, and we really need to bite the bullet to move Pennsylvania out of the bottom of the states and move them at a minimum up to the middle of the states, middle of the pack in terms of states and state support for our higher education. And I'm on the University of Pittsburgh board. I'm on the CCAC board. And we struggle with this conversation every day and in terms of making ends meet and cutting programs and the like to be able to offset the increased costs associated with educating kids. We have more work to do in the higher education space, and that's a priority of what we're looking at. We've put together a higher education funding commission that's looking at this, and we're going to continue to take those steps to do that. I mentioned earlier on the call the Nellie Bly Scholarship Fund that Governor Wolf is proposing, and that's something I think will provide loan forgiveness to folks.
Who would that be for, Senator?
For current students who are in, if it passes and hasn't passed yet, it would be for current students who are in the state system of higher education. So you mentioned you were a Penn State person. As the laws, as the proposal is written right now, would only include the state system schools, which would be IUP, Indiana, Edinburgh, Clarion, Mansfield, you know, Westchester, Shippensburg, all the other ones, Cheney. So we have more work to do to broaden that conversation, quite frankly. But that's just putting more money into the system. I think we need to do more on the other end in terms of the expenditure side, in terms of why does it cost so much? Why are we spending so much in our schools and our universities? What do we need to do to ratchet down the rising cost of that education? That's what we also have to do as well. So it's a two-pronged approach that we have to take. You mentioned Penn Hills being giving a good education. They are still giving good education to kids.
Well, it is. I have to peacefully disagree with you. I recently moved back to Penn Hills. I moved into the house that my parents built for retirement because I'm retired. And I've lived in Mount Lebanon, and my children went to school there, and in Upper St. Clair, and many, many different districts. Penn Hills is nothing like it used to be, and we need help.
And we've been providing help and providing resources to offset the financial situation. But at the end of the day, I respectfully disagree that they're not on the right track. I think they are clearly on the right track. When you compare them to Upper St. Clair and Mount Lebanon, I think that's an unfair analysis, I would say. Clearly, we want all of our kids to have the best education possible. But when you're looking at the tax base that Upper St. Clair has and Mount Lebanon has, they're able to spend considerable more dollars on their students and programming that affords them the opportunity to be able to do more along the lines of working to help to educate their kids. But I am confident that the Penn Hill School District will continue to prosper and do well, as they have been doing, trying to address the financial hole that they find themselves in from actions a number of years ago. But the quality of the education, in my view, is really one that I think people should recognize as being very solid and very good. And I think that their leadership will continue to be able to demonstrate that. So thank you very much for your call.
All right, that was a great conversation about higher education funding and student debt. Let's look at the other end of the spectrum for education funding. We have a question about early ed from Marilyn in Wilkinsburg. Marilyn, you are live.
Thank you, Senator Costa, for taking my call. I want to first congratulate you for all the good work you do.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank the governor for addressing early childhood education. And I know this is maybe hitting you with specifics aren't really known at this point, but how does the governor see this being enacted? And will parents have to pay for this, or is this going to be through the school districts? How is this going to work?
Are you referring to the increase in early learning dollars?
Yes.
Yeah, no, this would be the parents. This would be money that would make its way through the pre-K counts program.
Yes.
It would increase the allocation from the state to these programs by $25 million and then an additional $5 million to the Head Start program. So this would just be an expansion of the amount of slots, quite frankly, that will be available to folks to participate in and help maintain, you know, good, high-quality pre-K programs across Pennsylvania. We're also looking at doing more in that 0-3 space, the toddler space, developing more slots there, because that is equally important. The more money and resources we can put in that space creates a better foundation for the kids going forward. So parents would still need to participate at some level if they have the means to do so, but at the end of the day, this is an increase. I think this will probably be the fifth straight increase we've made into pre-K counts and also into Head Start. So it's a good step in the right direction, probably added close to $140 or $150 million over the course of the past 5 years, if we get this $25 million. And I do believe that we will. We've been pretty consistent about enhancing the investments we make in early learning because the programming has gotten better. We drove resources into there's a STARS program, and the STARS 3 and 4 are good.
Right.
Boost STARS 1 and 2 up to a level where they become 3 or 4 STARS where they have great success. The other thing the governor's proposing with some of these resources, other resources, not in this piece, not the $25 million, would be encouraging employers to develop early learning child care type program, to spaces in their employment, to allow people who have families, maybe single moms or single dads, the opportunity to bring their kids into a place where they can have a child care service or center there to allow that. So trying to build something along those lines in some of our private sector.
Well, thank you, and thank the governor. And in addition to slots, and I've worked with pre-K programs, so I'm pretty familiar with that. In addition to more slots, which is definitely needed, we also need more money per slot.
We're going to try to do that. Some of this may go towards that. At the end of the day, we've not finalized the specific how it's going to be driven out specifically. But the goal is from a 35,000 foot view is to put more money into early education, something we are going to consistently do through this process. That's our goal, and that's what we're going to continue to be able to do.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we still have a couple more calls here. We've got about 15 minutes left in our telephone town hall tonight, so if you have a question, hit *3 now. I want to make sure that we get to everybody. Moving away from budget issues, we have a question from Peggy in Squirrel Hill about the election process. Peggy, you're live.
Hi, Peggy.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking this call, Senator Costa. And I wanted to say that I'm very concerned about the security of the upcoming elections. And I'd like to know what will be in place statewide as well as locally in the upcoming elections that will be ready to go when the elections actually occur.
That's a great question. It's very timely. Earlier today in my caucus, I had the Secretary of State, Kathy Buchvar, come in and explain some of the very things you just asked us. A number of my colleagues have asked me, what are we doing along those lines? And then earlier today, County Executive Rich Fitzgerald was here in Harrisburg, and we had a brief discussion along those lines as well. As you may know, and many of the listeners may know, Allegheny County is changing its system to a paper-verified process where folks would scan, would fill out a ballot with an oval, mark who they're supporting, run it through the scanner, drops into a box, and then if there's any inconsistencies that we'd have the paper ballot to be able to go back and verify the vote total. Those are individual scanning devices that will be available at all these different types of precincts. That data is then collected and then taken down to the county. Chain of custody was a very specific question that was asked with respect to these cartridges and the like that would be doing that, as well as the individual ballots. Speaking with the secretary, I think there's about $15 million that the federal government is providing us to allow her to be able to implement a series of voter protection type security measures that we're going to be looking at and doing as we go forward. So I think that's very important. But the security of the election is something, and integrity of the election is something that's very important to us, and we're going to continue to work along those lines. The specifics of which, some of which can be detailed, some of which I think they're maintaining a level of I don't want to say privacy, but they need to monitor what they disclose in terms of how that's going to be done. I know the University of Pittsburgh, through former U.S. Attorney David Hickton, did a very comprehensive study in this space and making sure that we don't get to a place where we have some problems along those lines. I will assure you that we will not be addressing or having the same type of problems that we experienced or was experienced last evening in Iowa. And so I think that that's a little different process than what we're dealing with. But I'm comfortable and confident that the new machines, I think, are going to allow folks to have ease in voting, provide some additional backup and security along those lines. And I believe that the Department of State and the counties, individual counties, are working well to address and security and voting integrity, which I think is important. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah.
If you have a more specific question, please ask.
Well, I guess I wanted to ask just quickly, each county had the option to decide which types of voting machines or voting processes to use. Is that correct? So that each county, but they had to have a verifiable. Was that the rule that each of the counties had to have a verifiable method of?
That is correct. That was the governor's charge to every county, and I believe the county has complied. And in fact, last year when we made election changes to Election Law and Act 77, we also provided $90 million to that we voted on. We did a bond issue for $90 million that has been distributed to the counties to assist them in paying for the new county voting machines. So the answer is yes, and we're well down that path. Some counties had done it, made those changes in the fall of last year. A number of counties like Allegheny County will be experiencing for the first time these new voting machines, as I described, in this primary election, and we'll go forward from there.
And just one further question.
Sure.
Do we know at this time how far in advance people will be permitted to vote for by absentee ballot?
Yes.
Without you know, without having to say that you were out of state or have some excuse.
So we have now the new law we passed that I supported in Act 77 last year allows for what's referred to as a no-fault absentee ballot, which means that if you feel like you don't, you may be out of town, you may not be out of town, but or you may just want to not have to travel to your polling place on election day, you have two options. One is to ask for an absentee ballot without providing an excuse. So you go through the traditional process where you you file the application, they send you a ballot, you fill out your ballot, you mail it back in. The ability to get your ballot, the ability to ask for an absentee ballot, I think starts in a week or 10 days. That'll be available for folks to be able to do that, to get the application. And then the second piece is what we now have referred to as mail-in balloting. You can also do a request to get a mail-in ballot as well, and that's something that's going to be advanced as we go forward. The third thing that's being contemplated by the county is being able to kind of vote in person prior to the election. And some it looks to be 50 days in advance. So right now, let's say, you know, 3 weeks from now or 4 weeks or a month from now, if an individual wants to go and vote in person at the county election department, at that point what they do is they request an absentee ballot at the counter. They verify who they are. They're given an absentee ballot. They can fill it out right there and give it back to the election department individual. That is a form of early voting as well. Now, the question becomes, to what degree do we also authorize the counties to have what I'll call satellite locations. And we're permitted to have them at any site that is a county-owned site or a county lease site. So, for example, if the county wanted to do so, they could set up, for example, at a local fire hall that has a significant structure that allows for a lot of people to vote and has parking. They, and appropriate internet connectivity, they can simply go and show up on a particular, maybe the two Sunday or two Saturdays before election. The county says we're going to take early voting on these two dates at these times. People can go there and vote early. The county hasn't made a decision on that yet. We're working towards that along those lines. But that's still up in the air. But the absentee ballot, no fault, is 50 days in advance of the election day.
And it's elections only. It's not the primaries. Is that correct?
Well, no, it'd be the primary. Excuse me. It's either election, primary or the general. Yes.
Or the election. Okay. All
right. So the first opportunity for the Act 77 reforms is going to be this primary. So we have two things going on in Allegheny County. We have new machines, and we have new processes by which people can vote. And that's why we're going to be disseminating a lot of information along those lines. In fact, probably in mid to late March, I'm going to be doing a sort of a town hall, community town hall, where I'm going to ask people to come to a location, possibly two times, one in the evening and one on a Saturday morning. I'm going to have someone from the Department of State come and explain all the changes that I just tried to explain, just one of them. But also I intend to have there a sample of a voting machine. So I've been working with the manufacturer of the scanners. I asked them to bring a couple scanners to allow folks to get a feel for exactly how this is going to take place. So folks will be able to come to one of these two locations and fill out a sample ballot and, you know, do the oval experience, put it through the machine, watch it drop into the basket or the box, and just to experience an opportunity to see how it's going to work. My hope is that it makes it more efficient on election day, because I think this will be a new process to a lot of folks, and I'm concerned that that we don't have necessary. I hope that we have the necessary personnel there, and that they understand exactly what needs to be done. So, just trying to make the process easier. But thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, we are getting down to our last couple of minutes here, but if you still have a question, you can hit *9, and we'll take your questions and answer them from Senator Costa's office later. We have a question now about property taxes. I know this is something that you were speaking about earlier today,
yep.
Senator Costa, with
yep.
some reporters. So we're going to go to Antoinette in Oakmont. Antoinette, you're live.
Hi. Property owners get hit with school taxes twice, local taxes when the school board raises it, and in their property taxes. And one suggestion I have to save money for the school budget is to go to one superintendent per county instead of one superintendent per school district. I lived in North Carolina, and it worked very well there. And the school board here has been raising the local taxes almost yearly. And also, property owners should not bear the burden of the school taxes. My school taxes of my for my property are several thousand dollars a year. And to me, that sounds like a very old idea of when rich people are the only ones that could afford property, so therefore they could afford the school taxes. I think it should be spread out to maybe working people or something like that. Older retired people cannot afford to stay in their homes because of the property taxes and oftentimes move out of state.
I think you raise a very, very good point. There are a number of initiatives around the property tax and reforming our property tax situation. I spoke to the governor this week about putting together a conversation maybe across the state that may be happening very soon. To hear from folks around the Commonwealth and all the counties about what the impact of property taxes has been. You're right. It's an antiquated way in which we collect our taxes and pay for our schools in particular. There have been a lot of proposals out there to talk about increasing the sales tax or expanding the base of the sales tax, increasing the personal income tax, redirecting the money from the gaming fund, which is about $800 million. If we eliminate school property taxes, we're probably talking about a $7 to $8 billion structural hole we would have, that we'd have to find replacement revenue for that. And I think that's really been the problem. It's been difficult to get folks to focus and concentrate on a single plan about how we do that, and I think that conversation will ramp itself up again. There have been a number of initiatives along the lines of trying to address just senior property taxes, for example. So if you're a senior and you have a property tax increase in your school district, that we would freeze your property taxes. But again, to be able to do that, we'd have to find a revenue stream and about $60 million to be able to pay for that statewide. So these are some of the challenges that we have. The shifting from property taxes to sales tax or some other type of tax, to get to $6 billion, it gets to be a pretty significant increase in the sales tax or combined with a personal income tax increase. So that's the challenge that we have. It's going to be an issue we're going to talk about, and I think it's one that I think warrants further conversation as we go forward. So thank you very much for your call.
All right, Senator Costa, we're down to the last couple of minutes here. Do you have any last thoughts for anybody?
Well, I want to thank everyone for participating and listening to this conversation. Please know that we will be doing some other telephone town halls over the course of the year and some personal ones where people will be able to come to a particular forum. But at the end of the day, it's important for me to hear from folks what's on their mind, what are the concerns that they have, whether tonight about the governor's budget, but also as it relates to other matters of concern to them, whether it be school district issues, whether it be, you know, mentioned earlier just now, the property taxes. There are a lot of issues that are out there. Please feel free to reach out to us. Give our office a call at 412-241-6690. We're happy to meet with you and discuss some of these issues that are important to all of you. So thanks again. Have a good evening. And, again, thank you for listening.
All right. Now, if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, you can remain on the line, leave a voicemail for Senator Costa, and we'll get back to you. So, again, thank you for participating in Senator Costa's telephone town hall. You've been a great audience. We've covered a really broad number of topics. You can find more information about Senator Costa's positions on any number of bills on his website at senatorcosta.com or on his social media pages, which you can find on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So thank you for sharing your evening with us. Good night.